Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the Mokya or Mokna podcast. My name is Max Cohen. I'll be one of your hosts today. 12:05 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, when I am getting together with my co-host, as always, Mr. Colborne Bell, founder of the Museum of Crypto Art. Colborne, how are we finding you today?
Well, sick as a dog, but I'm here and I'm loving it. You haven't done this in a while, so.
You don't sound sick.
Yeah.
Yeah, you sound pretty good. Fair enough.
I've been trying to take care of myself. Sipping that throat coat, sucking on some Ricolas.
You should check out Fisherman's Friend. They're disgusting throat lozenge. They taste like nothing else I've ever tasted on earth, but boy, this is just like a shot of menthol.
Interesting. Yeah, I've been doing that oil of oregano.
You said olive oil and oregano?
No, oil of oregano.
Ah, I've never heard of that, but I'm not Italian, so.
You should get into that.
Oil of oregano and Fisherman's Friend. We go from the Mediterranean to the stormy waters of the Northern Atlantic.
Right.
All right. So this is a Mokya or Mokna podcast. What we do on every podcast is we kind of go over some news, some big events, some opinions. We just take a stock of everything that's going on in crypto art, crypto, and otherwise, and we assign it one of two qualifiers. Mokya, woo, or Mokna. So just as an example, I'll start. Colborne, you're sick. I would assign that a Mokna.
That's a major Mokna, bro.
So easy. You get it? We get it. Let's move on. Let's just jump right into Mokya or Mokna this week. We really got to start getting some audio effects going. Maybe I'll throw them in here.
Very cool.
Pausing to allow an audio effect to go in there. I'm going to explore this.
I can just human beatbox.
I was thinking more like a Royal Rumble kind of stuff.
Slide whistle?
That might be a bit too much.
Yeah.
All right. So we have a lot to get to today because we have not Mokya'd or Mokna'd anything over the last couple of weeks. So let's jump right in with something that I thought was a really clear indicator of where we are in crypto and crypto art, especially these days. Maybe it's more apt to say the entire NFT sphere. First Mokya or Mokna of the day. Yuga Labs, which bought Proof and Moonbirds and all of those IPs from Kevin Rose within the last calendar year, announced that it is revoking its CCO nomenclature on all of its Moonbirds products. So real quick, Moonbirds, strange little NFT project that came out, I believe, in early 2022 by Proof, which is Kevin Rose's company. We have Mokna'd Kevin Rose to death on this show. He's no longer involved. When Moonbirds first came out, and this is why this is hilarious, Moonbirds were minted. And the deal was that if you owned one, you had full commercial rights to the images, to the aesthetics, to whatever you wanted to do with it, but only to the holders. And then in August of 2022, I guess bowing to public pressure, Proof announced that they were actually changing all the Moonbirds to CCO. So now everyone had unlimited commercial right to use Moonbirds as they saw fit. And all these holders who had been promised exclusive commercial rights were suddenly very upset. And there was was looking this up the other day. There's all these articles about Proof holders being maligned by Proof's tactics. So anyways, yeah. Proof gets bought, Moonbirds get bought, and then Moonbirds are announced that they are going to restore commercial rights only to holders. And not only is this a very complicated legal precedent, because generally speaking, once you have something denoted as CCO, which means, again, full commercial rights to whoever wants to use it, there are no limits to when something can be used. Think of Xcopy with all of their works. Just you can just mint it, you can make remixes, whatever. You can't really revoke that, but you also can't really institute it after the fact. You kind of have one chance to bestow commercial rights onto something. So it gets into all these strange questions of like, well, if commercial rights were first granted to only holders and then it was made CCO and then it was reverted back, what's the precedent here that actually has legal standing? I'm not sure there is one. Colborne, first of all, did you pay attention to this as it was going on?
Yeah, I mean, a little bit. It's totally insane, you know? I think you said it right. This is kind of a marker of, like, what is going on. So I don't really have much of an opinion here other than just like a major moke nah for all the wavering, but it's very clear that, you know, when commercial interests come against, you know, what started as kind of like an independent indie artist movement, there's going to be conflict.
It just, yeah, I mean, this is a pretty clear and convincing moke nah, because we never like when something is granted CCO rights and then that is revoked, which again, I believe is illegal. We need a legal opinion on that. But at least when this news first broke, the general opinion I seem to keep seeing on my timeline was that you can't actually revoke something at CCO. But I think that there's just a fascinating new pandering to the same commercial interests that it was very cool and countercultural to rail against by everyone, you know, in the last bull market and just thereafter, right? Like the way Moonbirds were first posited, all these things was Moonbirds, it was Art Gobblers, all these stupid PFPs that were promoted as like the Art Collectors PFP project.
Right.
Then as soon as they like lose their value, and you know, now it seems like we are in this moment where more commercial interests, more like mainstream commercial interests, are trying to like legally find their way into quote unquote Web3 culture. Now we're starting to see like backward bends and gymnastics to try and accommodate them. And it seems like it's getting sillier and sillier.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of that. I think there's a lot of mental gymnastics going on right now, trying to justify all of the perhaps insanity that came before, or trying to ring fence gatekeep. But the bottom is falling out. We're in like complete free fall. Nobody knows where the morals and ethics and anything of this space are. And there's no ground anymore. There's no grounding.
Is it more depressing or exhilarating to you that even large, at this point, like multinational corporations like Yuga Labs also don't know where the bottom or the ground is?
I mean, for me, that's exhilarating. I have not been shy about, you know, the artificiality that they brought to the space that resulted in, you know, I think everybody is kind of eating their own dog food at this point in the cycle.
That was evocative.
Yeah. I mean, this is really, I think, reaping what you sow. Like, who is your community? You know, if it's a bunch of like Moonbirds, bro, that's just price go up. When price goes down, you know, everybody rushes to the exits.
Let me ask you another question. You know, when I first came into NFTs, the idea of identifying with a PFP was, it was at its, you know, most feverish height, right? Whether that was a Bored Ape or a CryptoPunk or even just like one kind of cohesive image, you know, whether it was a CryptoFunk or whatever, one of those larva lad things that you love so much. Like people identified very much with their PFP and they didn't really change it. And that kind of like identification with a digital avatar seems to have kind of gone away. People are now more themselves, I suppose. At least that's the kind of rub that I get from just the accounts that I follow and the people I see. There's less of an insistence on this is my avatar and it's not changing because people identify with this single image. And it seems like this Moonbirds move is almost an attempt to restore that, as in like all of these things had kind of gone through the CCO cycle and it became less and less of a flex, I suppose, to have one single PFP. But I don't know.
I haven't seen a Moonbird on the timeline in forever.
Yeah.
I don't know who is stepping up and fronting that. You know, you still see punks. I still think, unfortunately, punks are kind of like a little bit of that shine and luster has definitely fallen off.
Sure. But I think that there's like there's a metaverse component to this too, right? The idea behind this CCO revocation of Moonbirds is that, you know, at some point in theory, Yuga will be releasing their other side metaverse where all the Bored Apes and CryptoPunks and all the other brands that they have come to own or have a hand in are all going to be like playable as characters. And it seems like they are angling themselves to, or I guess angling the culture to begin to identify with one avatar again, which kind of spits in the face of what I see from a lot of other metaverse developers, especially like Polygonal Minds and the people at Vipe who are, they just release all these different metaverse avatars, like one for every mood. You know, you're not necessarily being identified with just a physical or quote unquote physical appearance, but like more with your name and kind of your like activity within the community. And it's interesting to kind of see a move more in the direction of complete identity alignment with like a digital asset again, which I feel like we kind of lost.
I mean, how much time have any of us spent in the metaverse?
I mean, personally, in the past,
like a year. Yeah, I mean, likewise.
But then again, I mean, like, this isn't just a quirk that's unique to Yuga. I mean, I know that like Cyber Brokers, Josie Bellini's project, when Cyber Brokers were released, then there were all these quests and you would get these mech parts and you would assemble these like unique mechs. And then the mechs would, you would get like a rigged 3D avatar that you could use. And there was a certain kind of, it was posited as a benefit to holders, right? That you would have this recognizable and unique 3D avatar that you could use. But I don't know, I'm just interested in like what this maybe a we're seeing the preemption to a return of identification with digital assets again that I think we kind of lost over the last lost just over the course of the bull market.
Yeah, I mean, when the money dries up, the attention dries up as well, right? When 90% of your community was in there for speculative interest, then they're gonna leave. So I am just like generally shocked and a little bit appalled that there is no like underlying philosophy left. Right, there's nobody talking about where this thing is going or what happened. It seems to be either I can't really make sense of what the timeline is anymore.
Yeah, it does. Everything does seem kind of like anachronistic to each other, that there's just like there are no, like, at least at this moment, not a ton of like overarching narratives.
Right. Nobody is taking this work and putting it in the metaverse and doing shows and doing it. You know, there's certainly people trying to like get by and making new projects and sharing new art, and that will continue forever. But this idea of an extension beyond the art and who is going to be there and come in and be a patron and support and collect, it's definite. We're not growing.
I know we're spending a lot of time on this, but I just want to say, like, you know, one of the first pieces I wrote for Mocha was basically a defense of PFPs, that it was so interesting that you could purchase a piece of art in theory, at least some kind of aesthetic, and then incorporate your identity into that aesthetic, right? And that was kind of a new paradigm, that it wasn't just buying art so that you could, you know, show it on your wall and it would have some kind of like delineation of your taste, but that it would be so caught up with the identity that people were knowing you as.
Yeah, I've come full circle. I mean, I actually think PFPs also are very, very important, right? It's just like you look around and there's very few projects that actually kind of capture at this point something I would want to be a part of, which is frightening.
It's also frightening to see how quickly these communities change and how obviously like tied up it is with the underlying price of the thing. Obviously, Bored Apes are completely out of style right now. And I think that that's actually the correct terminology, like completely out of style. You don't see a lot of people like rocking fucking Mutant Ape.
ETHs anymore. I mean, their bid has come back. I know they were like down around 10 ETH, they're back up to 15 ETH. I don't know if we've seen that, you know, and it's not to say that I really genuinely believe that all of the stories that were told the first go around are going to be told again. So this PFP story is going to be told again. But I'm really curious to see where value accrues. And I actually do still believe value can and will accrue to CryptoPunks. But the Bored Ape Yacht Club story in particular is one that is very, very tenuous in my opinion. So I'm curious who is going to come in and get behind that.
Do you think when this narrative does replay itself, do you think it'll be these kind of like, I'm going to call them like legacy PFPs at this point, whether that's Bored Apes, CryptoPunks, Nouns, the things that had like a lot of cultural significance in the last cycle, or whether it will be a kind of a new contingent of projects that are maybe like, I don't know, made by folks who have a little bit more cultural affirmation today?
Yeah, I think we can only look into the past of what happened from like bull market to bull market in crypto, and that, you know, out of the top 10 cryptos in 2017, maybe like two were left on the list in 2021. And there is still some value to those legacy things. There's always going to be like perceived historical value that could encourage people to come in and buy these things. But I think generally it accrues into new places.
It'll be interesting to see how those develop. All right, let's move on to the next Mokyar Mokna of the day. So I guess this was about a week ago at this point. Latasha, the wonderful Web3 music maker, at Call Me Latasha, was hacked and seems to have had her wallet drained. And in the aftermath to that, there was the release of a free mint on Zora, which people could mint, and then all of the like mint fees, because Zora incentivizes people to release like free mints, and then they provide something out of their coffers to the whatever the minting fund is, and all of that money would go back to Latasha, essentially. And it seems like she was able to raise a fair amount of money this way, or at least achieve pretty large amount of community support. I saw that this was kind of playing itself out the timeline over the course of a couple of days. And I mean, first of all, big Mokia for me for just like community action and support of somebody who seems to be doing a lot of really, really good work over a long period of time. But I want to talk about this like possibility of fundraising for any number of causes using like site incentives, right? And whether that's a way we can kind of like communally hack the like business models of larger companies. No, what were you going to say?
Well, I mean, this is what we've been trying to do, you know. This incentive thing is how we bootstrap, you know, it's mostly kind of like a DeFi thing, but TVL, like total value locked inside these protocols. So giving out incentives up front to get people, but I really don't believe that, you know, you have to have a use case greater than just subsidizing behavior.
Can you speak a little bit more about that?
Yeah, you know, I don't want to say the token mechanism going back was an incredible way to financially align communities, right? It put people in the same boat holding the same thing with the same purpose. Now, you know, that purpose was generally to shill to new money. And you see it from meme coins, you see it to DeFi, you see it all the way across the board. But the way to get past the cold start problem in a lot of these entities is to subsidize the behavior of actors on the network. You know, and I know one that people have been talking about very frequently lately is Blast, right? And people locked up a bunch of Ethereum into Blast. I don't really know because I don't really play these games anymore. But at some point, there's like so many people following the same thing that, you know, the return on it is effectively nothing. Or there was the protocol that just, it was Eigenlayer.
Yeah.
That like, you know, had everybody locked up for however long and then geo-blocked US and Canada.
Which, yeah, I think this is important, but I think that there's a subsection of this, which is more what I'm interested in exploring, right? Because you have these protocols which are trying to incentivize action in a certain way. And you're going to end up finding naturally, like, or at least in this case of Zora, and then, you know, Latasha being able to like make some money back on what are essentially these protocol based incentives that are trying to draw the community into certain actions. You're seeing it leveraged for purposes that might not have been like in the protocol's initial interests. Now, of course, we're talking about Zora today, so perhaps that is what they were trying to do in the first place. But I wonder if there's an exploitation of that we're not quite seeing yet. Like,
it's a centralization. I mean, like, I love Latasha. I'm really sorry that happened to her. There's been a lot of really intricate scams going around. And, you know, that's certainly an effect of Spotlight, right? I think she used to work or continues to work with Zora. And, you know, they can shine the spotlight on somebody like that. But for every one person that they choose to highlight, there's 100 other people out there who got hacked and don't have that same recourse, right? So it's... You know, crypto is great in that way that we can all kind of step up for each other in the time of need, but it's also really cutthroat in, you know, maybe there's also people that don't feel that don't have that same sense of community.
Do you think it is incumbent on platforms that have like either large coffers or large kind of like centralized attention to do more of a part in, you know, featuring or promoting, you know, individuals like Latasha who have either, you know, been hacked or been subject to some kind of like negative, I don't know, some negative experience of some kind, and kind of putting their weight behind that. Like, it seems like there is a version here, a symbiotic relationship between something that is helping an artist or a community member that also reflects positively on whatever of whichever protocol that is being involved in this. It seems like there is a like the net positive game here to be played between like investment in the community in a way which like,
yeah, I mean, look, I'm going to be the capitalist pessimist here and say that the corporation never does anything that is outside the corporation's goals, right? So even if it seems to be an altruistic act, ultimately, you know, it is probably for the net benefit of the corporation. And I think this goes hand in hand with the discussion that a lot of people have been having lately around Super Rare and Zach coming out saying that, you know, open to lowering fees for artists. Because it's, yeah, it's like, what is that platform doing for its users? At a time like this, that's a really, really difficult question.
And yeah, I guess maybe there is a, it's kind of exclusively in the realm of like providing, finding creative ways to bring like funds back into holders and giving them like a financial incentive to use platforms and a financial incentive to like promote platforms. I think that like,
I mean, at the end of the day, like, I think the goal here is that there needs to be some sort of broader artist social safety net, right? Mm-hmm. I think that's kind of what I'm getting at, that it can't really just be like individual based and, you know, and kind of like accounting for the people who are already close into the system, but it needs to be broader. And it gets really, really difficult, obviously, trying to design or promote or do something like that. So like one off, you know, it's incredible, and I'm glad. I'm sorry it happens. It's great that people rallied around this person, because this person definitely, definitely deserves it. But at the same time, you know, if the goal is like sustainability beyond the individual, like sustainability for the space, then we need to think more along the lines of how we kind of like support each other in this community.
Do you think there's something here to be said for like Warpcast as a platform which allows these kinds of like community incentives and community safety nets, in the sense that like you are able, using Warpcast, to like provide tokens to the community which they can use to then like tip their friends, tip people?
Yeah, but think of the economics of this. It never makes sense. All of these SocialFi economics are broken, right? Because if you are tipping money out, then those people are selling. They're paying the rent, the subsidies go down over time, you've bootstrapped some initial users, but eventually when those tips dry up, those users leave, right? And all that leaves us with at the end of the day is hyper-fragmented social media that isn't really serving the needs of anybody. Everybody just ends up kind of like burnt out and all over the place. And, you know, there's such a focus on driving short-term behavior that nobody ever really cares to think about long-term consequences.
Yeah, I guess maybe my point is more like, if you have some kind of platform that basically allows the community to continue to connect whatever like short-term project at that moment has attention and community support, then you can kind of continue to like provide that safety net in many different forms in whatever the like fabric of the day is, whether it's DGen or Rare or whatever the token will be that, you know, somebody uses Warpcast to get into people's hands, you know, tomorrow, next week, next month. Obviously, yeah, the burnout of following that constantly is dangerous, but there will always be people who are going to follow those coins around and follow those safety nets around, because being literate in them is going to provide a like social and financial edge to them. So I just wonder if there will always be, you know, obviously like DGen or MoneySide and DGen was, I think, the first currency to like be used on Warpcast in a way where you can just like basically like tip your friends and tip artists that you like and throw some money into their, there's like a point system and a wallet. It's semi complicated, but like, if you can continue to do this over and over again with whatever the coin is of the day, then essentially this goes back to like what I was speaking of with Zora, where you're like using these protocols, you're like kind of hacking these protocols for the sake of like continuously supporting the other folks that you see in your community.
But it's not sustainable economics, and it all goes to zero. And, you know, you are, you know, if you are an early beneficiary inviting people in, well, then it does become a bit of a pyramid scheme, because eventually, you know, the music stops, everybody scrambles to find a chair, and undoubtedly somebody you invited in is left holding the bag, right? And that is where we're failing to create virtuous self-sustaining cycles in this, right? Because maybe you go and you post that you made $10,000 in DGIN last month, and then somebody comes online and they grind and they grind and they grind, and you know, maybe for the same amount of time they make $2,000. They post it, somebody comes in, they grind, and they make $200. I don't know. You know, I just am so wary of what feels to me like MLM schemes.
What is an MLM scheme?
It's a multi-level marketing scheme.
Uh-huh.
You know, where like, because you're early, you know, meme coins have it, but it's pretty much foundational crypto.
Wow, Colburn's back in the, this is all Ponzi-nomics train.
Look, a lot of it is. I mean, you go, there was whatever, that Bloomberg article that went through and listed like top 10 vaporware blockchains. And, you know, tell me, as somebody who is rather new to Solana being number 5, Solana is like effectively unusable. Right. There are like so many failed transactions. There's like, it's just kind of a cluster F. But that's a $68 billion market cap. And I get they could like go through that. But once you start to go below that list, well, it's really like questionable what the actual utility of a lot of these tens of billion dollar market cap blockchains are.
Is there one ingredient that you see, or a couple ingredients that you see are missing to making these things self-sustainable, or is this a secret sauce that we haven't really figured out the ingredients for yet?
You know, I think like all of tech, it's just a UI UX issue, and we'll probably get there in 10, 20 years. But we're certainly, generally feels like we're paying a premium on a lot of these things to speculate right now, because, you know, the exchanges and the VCs behind this and all of it have a financial incentive to prop these things up. As we've said a million times on the show, it's price that drives narrative, not narrative that drives price.
Well said. I thought that was going to start off as a pretty simple mokya, but now it's kind of a mok. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it's always nice. It's hard. It's, you know, I think I have, you know, I'm veering back towards pessimism.
We're back.
Yeah. I wish I could see the bottom or the light at the end of the tunnel, but I just see generally more people discouraged or leaving. More fragmentation, and you know, I think everything that we were preaching, we were promised, has devolved into the casino. And we have, you know, just go look at what happens when like a city brings a casino into their town.
What happens?
Well, you have crime increases, you have poverty increases, you have, you know, drug use spiraling. I don't think it's, you know, you have an increased tax base, but then you have all these like carry on effects that are incredibly negative.
Well, I guess this is ends up being somewhat of a moke now, but I want to continue on this topic a little bit because it factors in the next thing that I wanted to mention. I had seen somebody tweet out something along the lines of, if you're not farming on Blast, you're leaving money on the table, something to that effect. I don't use Blast. Blast is an L2 on top of Ethereum that was established by Blur, the OpenSea competitor, platform, marketplace, whatever you want to call it. And I have no interest in figuring out what's going on Blur, figuring out what's going on Blast, all these L2s. Like, there's just this burnout that I feel like is becoming pretty culturally common of like jumping across chains, looking for opportunity, playing these like crypto-based games and all these different casinos that you're basically like being invited to play in at all given at all these times. Right. And then Eigenlayer, when they, you know, revealed that their airdrop that so many people had staked their money for was either not available in so many locales, it was geo-locked and you couldn't use a VPN to take those funds out. Like, it just seems like there's all of these different casinos and you're constantly being asked to play in all of them. And the rewards are so abstract up front that it's so hard to, like, I don't know. I feel like it's hard to motivate myself to move past the few landscapes that I know, which is basically like touching on Solana and then like Ethereum art, and everything else feels just like so like terrifying and like exhausting.
Well, I agree with that, because there is real risk in going into new places, right? When you go into new places, this is how you get scammed. Mm-hmm. You know, when you sign new transactions, when you do things you've never done before, this is really how you get scammed. So is the potential reward there worth it when also like everybody is rushing there? I would say generally no way.
Just feels like if this is what decentralization is like, as in there are so many things happening on all these different chains at all these given moments, and that there's all this like chain abstraction, you're just moving between all these different places. Like if that's what decentralization looks like, or further decentralization looks like, it's like actually fairly like overwhelming and like unappealing.
Yeah, I mean, you also don't need to be everywhere. And frankly, the more dispersed we are, the more fragmented the value is, the more likely things are going to fail.
Yeah, this wasn't really a Mokna or a Mokya. It was just a Mok thought that I don't really have an answer to.
A Mok, ah.
Yeah, a Mok, hmm.
Yeah, I think I was touching on this before, and I don't really have a cohesive thought around it other than, you know, generally things are not what they appear to be.
They never seem to be.
Yeah. It's and also if everybody's doing it, like your return at the end of the day is going to be super, super low.
Yeah. It's like you always said about meme coins and such. By the time that we hear about them on Twitter, it's already too late to get in, which is the only place I ever hear about these things anyway.
Do I think Blast is going to be like a revolutionary L2? I don't, because how could it be? You know, it's just the Blur guys pivoting away from a marketplace and a market that they wrecked. You know, trying to take more money to go do like the next value up thing.
I wonder if there will be end up becoming like a new trend or a new meta where you have like a project or a meme coin or something, and then that ends up kind of like spiraling outwards into a like its own chain, and then you have all these things built on that chain to try and capitalize in the interest of like a coin or a platform or a marketplace or whatever, and then it just ends up being this like more and more kind of like abstracted scheming away from just like buying a coin and towards like people building on this coin to try and capitalize on attention.
Yeah, I mean it is that entirely. You know, when you look at the other side of the coin, right? You have two ecosystems that you can really develop in. You can develop in either Apple or Android.
Mm.
Right? And those are locked and the value is contained in those ecosystems.
Yeah.
And that is how like distribution occurs. Right. Mm-hmm. You look at crypto, incredibly fragmented across the board, tens of thousands of coins having all sorts of utilities and functions. And what are you supposed to do? Are you supposed, as a developer, I would imagine it's very difficult to try and like, I don't know. There's an incredible game of chicken happening all the time.
Well said.
Yeah.
Let's end with art I don't know the man too well, but it certainly seems like a Mokna, which is that Frank Stella, the pioneering painter and like abstract artist, passed away over the weekend. So that's a big Mokna because we love our historically significant artists to remain alive. But this leads into a really interesting question for me. You know, Vera Molnar, another like titan of 20th century artistry and like one of the most significant digital artists. She had passed away. I can't remember I think it was earlier this year, at age 99. I'm just curious, like, how do we honor the artists that came before crypto art? Especially because I feel like there's so much like the border, the native kind of language that we use is like antagonism towards traditional artistry in general, or just like the traditional art world. And we like pretty much lump everything that's not like self-proclaimed crypto art into this traditional art category, but it kind of feels wrong to me on its face to like lump folks like Frank Stella or Vera Molnar. Yes, both of them experimented with NFTs towards the end of their life, but it feels wrong to lump them in with like the traditional art world simply because like NFT tech wasn't available. I'm just curious in your opinion, like, or if you have an opinion, like how do we properly honor all of these like titanic artists that came before crypto art that, you know, even folks that we may see as kind of like dipping their toe in an attempt to like extract some value from it, but who are nonetheless very influential.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a beautiful thing for these people to choose to participate in this way, you know, at the later stages of their career and ultimately lives. But I think this entire show is striking at the heart of something that is like is just a conflict, and that crypto pushes things so far forward so fast that how do we give proper respect to like anything that came before? And when everybody is trying to chase like the new thing, the new farming, the new meta, the new whatever, I don't have an answer to that question. Do you?
I'm still yet to formulate it. I think it's kind of leading to like more questions for me. Like what's top of mind for me is this question of like how much investment into crypto art is necessary for an artist to be like a crypto artist, right? Like take a Vera Molnar who released an NFT project, or Frank Stella who released an NFT project. That, I mean, it was certainly art. It was certainly like based in blockchain. Like, I guess the question becomes like, how do we define the crypto artist in a world where like this, like blockchain is no longer a super difficult ecosystem to get into, right? When it's more available to people who have less and less like tech savvy, and you have artists who, you know, maybe their oeuvre or their practice is not predominantly on the blockchain. Like, how do we characterize these folks as either crypto artists or like extractive? I don't have an answer to that, but I think it's really interesting. You know, we had spoken some months ago on this podcast about like, I think it was the Norman Rockwell estate was releasing like behind the scenes or like work in progress photographs or paintings rather as NFTs. And that felt extractive to me, right? It wasn't like doing anything to push the blockchain narrative. It wasn't blockchain nascent. It was just kind of like using the blockchain as for the market as opposed to the capabilities. But it seems like the more accessible the blockchain becomes, the more we will see artists who are not like honoring the legacy of crypto art, who are just going to dip their toe in. They're going to use this market. They're going to use the distribution mechanisms that are available here. Mm-hmm. And it further abstracts this question of like, who's a crypto artist and who's not, and whether there will be these camps of like, here are crypto artists and here's digital artists who use the blockchain, or here's just artists who use the blockchain in general, and whether it's necessary to have this kind of like division between camps. All of those things are fairly interesting to me. And, you know, when someone like Frank Stella passes away and you see, you know, a lot of people I respect, like Art Gnome, you know, giving flowers to Frank Stella, a figure who was obviously very influential to Art Gnome, very influential to all the art that gets made today, whether we're conscious of that influence or not. You know, just like, where does the buck stop with we're honoring this person because of their talent? Where does the buck stop in terms of like they had contributed to crypto art? Just gets more and more abstracted for me. It seemed like when I first came into this movement, it was very easy to tell who was a crypto artist and who was not. But the more time that goes on and the more people who end up in this ecosystem because they're chasing money on money in crypto or market in blockchain, that the division again between these like identities becomes more and more difficult to parse through.
Yeah.
So no, I don't really have an answer for you. It's just complicated.
Some good thoughts. Yeah.
I feel like this is what ends up happening during all of these like extended, like slow moments in crypto art, is we just end up asking these like further and further, like these more and more abstract questions about these more and more difficult questions. Like when we were on with Awful Eye the other day, like we just kept coming to these like obstacles in the road, these like really like difficult, seemingly important conceptual obstacles in the road. And it's like, there are no answers to them, but like the questions are being asked. And I feel like that's kind of this moment that we're in. Is like all of these questions are being asked, but we don't have any answers to them. And it doesn't seem like any answers are forthcoming.
Yeah. I mean, all the incentive structure across the board is wrong. The model is wrong. The types of projects that are getting funded is all wrong. There's no thought to sustainability. It's just like slash and burn. And, you know, maybe that is just kind of the problem with the world.
Yeah, maybe. I wonder if that problem would just be entirely like abstracted away if there were just more people. like just lots more people, lots more funding, lots more like getting in and getting out. Like,
I don't know. Do we see, I think, yeah. I mean, I guess there is some sort of corporate social responsibility at a higher level.
I mean, it's basically like saying, is any economy sustainable permanently? And the answer is probably no. But like, if we can abstract that sustainability onto a, you know, 100-year timeline instead of a, you know, 6-month timeline, it certainly seems a lot more sustainable than it does in crypto, which is so like hair trigger and accelerative and totally. And also short lived.
Totally.
Boy, that was a fun podcast.
Tough.
Yeah. A lot of exhaustion, a lot of burnout, a lot of it's a strange moment to be in crypto.
It's almost like I really actually do think it's an existential moment in the space.
It feels like an existential moment in general.
Yeah, like
economically, it feels like.
That's true.
I saw something. I sent it to my parents and my brother yesterday. It was like in 1980, you could buy 6 Big Macs with an hour of minimum wage, and they were 40% bigger. And now, 1 hour of minimum wage barely affords 1 40% smaller burger, despite minimum wage more than doubling in that time. And like, we're just seeing like purchasing power drop precipitously. And it's like, economically, it's just a very strange moment. More and more people in my life are talking about economics with a like intellectualized bent, and with like actual, they seem to have more of an idea of what they're talking about than I can remember. Maybe that's just because I'm older, but it certainly seems like, again, we're just in this very existential moment for what it means to like exist within an economy and see an economy that is.
I mean, people are getting squeezed to the margin, right? There is like, for the majority of people, no possibility ever of like home ownership or job security, or everything has been condensed into like a much smaller, tighter time frame. So I don't blame people for acting in the short term, acting perhaps more like irrationally or self-centered or self-interested, because yeah, I guess it's all reflecting what is happening to them, outside of them, through them, and in this collective idea of capitalism that we're experiencing.
Yeah, I feel like we've talked about before how like the inverse triangle of crypto ownership, that you start in crypto and then you end up buying these like digital assets like collectibles that ends up funneling back down to the art. But crypto is like a derivative asset that is like inherently unsafe and is inherently like volatile. And yeah. So if you have people who are just like afraid economically in these like larger terms with their fiat currency and with like their governments, then there's gonna be less people coming into crypto, less people who are in crypto who are then gonna keep making these like derivative bets outside of that on NFTs, then from NFTs into like art investment. I mean, obviously there's the Warren Buffett quote that gets thrown around where it's like, be brave when others are fearful, and be fearful when others are brave, or maybe it's bold when others are fearful. But like, how do you actually incentivize yourself to like make a 20-year bet on like an artist when, you know, you don't know if you'll have a job in a year and a half?
No, totally.
Well, anyways, we could probably talk this topic to death, but let's get out of here for today. And I'm sure we'll end up just coming back to it at some point in the near future. Colburn, any last words of encouragement, enlightenment, or fear abatement before we head out?
No, leave it there.
Yeah, leave it there. Leave everyone wishing and wanting for more. This has been another episode of Mokya or Mokna, the only podcast where two people purport at the beginning to have a purpose and a structure for their podcast, then immediately leave it behind. We hope you enjoyed being here with us. If you did enjoy this podcast, or at least find it intellectually stimulating, you can give us a follow or a subscribe or a 5-star review on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get this podcast, and we would really appreciate you do so. You can also give us a follow on Substack at museumofcrypto.substack.com, which I will say the content's a little bit more all around hopeful. I think I'm a more hopeful writer than I am a speaker, but
I think it's just me. I think I'm just sick.
We're all sick.
Yeah, but no, I'm...
Either way, we hope you enjoyed being here with us. We enjoy being with you. My name is Max. His name is Colborn, and we will see everyone real soon on the next Mokya or Mokna podcast. Thanks very much.
Bye, everybody.
Today's episode of Moke Ya or Moke Na was edited and produced by me, Max Cohen. A big thanks, as always, to my co-host, Colborn Bell, for being with me for another slobber knocker of a conversation. A big thanks to Julian Brangold for composing our intro and outro music. And of course, a big thanks to all of you for listening. We appreciate you being with us, and we hope you'll be with us next time on another episode of Moke Ya or Moke Na. So long.